This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to America's Secret Wars, your podcast all about the times the United States has used military force to fight or occupy foreign soil. I am your host, Trevor Cully, and with me today, I still have Roberto from the History of Socratvelo, Georgia, Czar Power, and soon to be from the Quest for Power podcasts.
Hello there.
How you doing these many days and weeks later since we last recorded?
It's been so long. I am doing fine and dandy. My derriere hurts from sitting in this chair for so long, but it's fine. I'm fine. You know, a bit of opium will help with that.
Yes. For anybody just joining us now, this is part two of our episodes on the Opium Wars. It says part two. I don't know why you would start here. You can. I'm not your boss. I don't think you should have a boss. But it might make more sense if you start with part one.
Go listen to part one. It's good, too. You get to hear all the jokes about the white sticky goo.
Yes, there was... That episode is just covered in white sticky goo. Just plastered all over its face.
A bukkake of sorts. I know it's the wrong country, but still.
Just a thick opium bukkake.
Yes.
All right. So we left off with the situation between the United States, the British Empire, and the Qing Dynasty of China around 1850. Just a few years after the end of the First Opium War and a few years before the beginning of the Second. To set the stage for the United States at this moment in time, Kansas was on fire, we were on the verge of a war against the Mormons over Utah, the concept of civil war was on everybody's mind, and we were actually on the verge of being drawn into open war in Nicaragua, which itself was ruled by an American at the time.
Wait, who's the American ruling Nicaragua? I know it's not the episode for this, but like, is it like O'Higgins or whatever?
Oh, no. Have you not heard this story?
No, I'm not.
At this point, the American lunatic adventurer, William Walker, was the dictator president of Nicaragua.
Huh, that's... an interesting.
He was not acting on behalf of the United States government. The United States was contemplating invading his country to force him out of power.
That is so weird.
That will absolutely be an episode of this podcast.
Okay, I can't wait to hear it. But yeah, oh yeah, but you said Kansas is on fire. What happened to be Bleeding Kansas?
Yeah, the Bleeding Kansas is in full swing. The only good man of the 19th century, John Brown, is running around the Kansas frontier with a broadsword murdering slavers.
I went to his, where did he die at? It was,
Harper's Ferry.
I went to Harper's Ferry a few years ago with Brendan. That was fun.
Well, I guess he died at a Maryland courthouse, but still.
Well, yeah, we made fun of the Daughters of Confederacy statue there, or... Because it's, losers. You know, exactly. You lost the war, get over it.
So here's the thing. Mm-hmm. If you couldn't tell from my description of the 1850s, it was a crazy fucking decade in the United States. I genuinely can't even begin to explain all of the wild stuff that coincided with the Second Opium War in the U.S., because that could be its own podcast. But here's the other thing. If possible, the 1850s were even more insane for China. I have read books, articles, etc., and listened to podcasts on a bunch of stuff in this bit of Chinese history. But the thing a lot of media talking about those events kind of skims over is that they talk about them in isolation. These were all happening at the same time. Have you ever heard of the Guizhou Uprising, when the Guizhou province rebelled against persecution of their ethnic minorities?
It sounds familiar, actually.
Well, you lived in China, so you might actually have heard of a couple of these.
Yeah.
Or the Panthei Rebellion, when the Muslim Hui minority rebelled near the modern Chinese border with Bangladesh. Or the Nian Rebellion, a generally anti-Qing revolt near the Yangtze and Yellow Rivers.
I've heard of that one.
Or the Dachang Rebellion on the southeast coast of China. I am guessing most people have not.
Yeah, you're not me. I'm sorry.
Thing is, most of those internal revolts broke out as side effects of Qing taxation in response to a different ongoing rebellion that overlapped with the Second Opium War, which also happened to be one of the deadliest conflicts in human history.
What?
Yeah. Like up there next to World War I in terms of overall deaths.
The Second Opium War.
Not the Second Opium War. This other thing going on at the same time. If you wrapped all of 1850s China into one casualty rate, it would be one of the deadliest conflicts in human history, hands down.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I was just confused there. I was like, what's the next thing? What is it? Tell me already.
So, the First Opium War left China militarily exhausted, and they followed it up immediately with a border dispute in Tibet by fighting the Sino-Sikh War against the Sikh Empire of Northern India.
That sounds pretty cool.
Like I said, there is so much going on in the 1850s.
Free Tibet.
Yeah. The Qing dynasty was swaying back and forth on a tightrope. And I want to preface this to listeners by saying that we quite simply do not have time to address this in detail. But it will absolutely be an episode of some sort soon. Here's that conflict up there amongst the bloodiest in all of human history. Roberto, what do you know about the time that China went to war against the younger brother of Jesus Christ?
Is this the Boxer Rebellion?
No. Yeah, that is 40 years in the future.
Wait. I've heard of this one. I've heard of this one, actually. This guy thought he was like Jesus Christ or his brother, and he just had this like whole like movement where he converted a bunch of people, and he was just a batshit crazy heretic. And then that's all I know. That's all I remember.
This is the Second Opium War coincides almost entirely with the Taiping Rebellion.
That's what it's called. Yes, I remember this now. I know this.
For centuries, the Chinese bureaucracy had run off strictly educated men who had to pass an extremely difficult exam on Confucian philosophy. People studied for decades to take this test. Families spent their life savings into training a son who could enter the imperial hierarchy.
Nothing's changed.
Yeah, really. Under the Qing dynasty, the terms of the exam were altered to not only allow Manchus to take it, instead of just the Han Chinese majority, but also, supposedly, to make it easier for the Manchus than the Chinese. This exacerbated ethnic tensions. In 1837, Hong Hoshu failed for the third time, inciting a psychological breakdown. Hong fell ill and began having dreams of a celestial divine family. In his dreams, his celestial father said that his true name was taboo, so he changed it to Hong Shiquan. He felt absolutely certain that these dreams were revealing some sort of divine truth, and when he failed his exams for a fourth time, Hong Shiquan snapped. But he also spent time with his cousin, a Christian convert, who had translated some Bible pamphlets. Then Hong went to spend some time with a Baptist missionary from the U.S.
Oh, no.
But he was refused baptism because, Hong's newfound interest in Christianity and his dreams mixed a little bit. Hong declared himself Hong Christ and began telling his family and the other people in his hometown that he was the second son of the Christian God. Not the second coming, but the literal younger biological brother of Jesus.
Oh, dear Lord.
That's, oh, dear Hong.
I'm sorry.
Hong began preaching, mixing elements of Christianity and various Chinese beliefs, gathering a huge following, and really honed in on that ethnic tension between Han and Manchu. In December of 1850, local government officials attempted to initiate a pogrom against this movement, which did not go as planned. Within a month, Hong Shiquan was at the head of a 10,000-man army and had declared his following the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom at war with the Qing Dynasty.
Okay, so gets denied into bureaucrat school, becomes a literal messiah. So if you get denied into becoming into a bureaucrat, you become a messiah. If you get denied into becoming into art school, you become a dictator.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
And if you get denied getting into Iranian studies school, you become a podcaster.
I didn't do that. What are you talking about?
There are many paths to the dark side.
I got denied for a Fulbright.
So this all started near modern Guiping in southeastern China and spread from there. By March of 1853, they had conquered Nanking. And within 2 months, they were nearing the gates of Beijing.
This seems like something we should continue following if it's this successful.
Obviously.
The Crusades weren't even this successful.
Over the next 2 years, a Taiping army marched north and assaulted the cities around Beijing, capturing many of them, and besieging the capital itself. Broadly speaking, Britain and the United States quietly supported the rebels with supplies and trade because they were kind of sort of Protestant, and they were weakening the Qing government.
You know, just like these imperial powers to support a rebellious group trying to overthrow the current government, you know, nothing's changed in history.
No, nothing ever changes. But this was all going on around Beijing. But it was not, like I said, the only thing going on. In March of 1854, the Qing Navy was besieging a group called the Small Sword Society at Shanghai.
So the size of your sword is how you use it.
Yeah. But while fighting the Small Sword Society, the Chinese attacked an American merchant ship called the Compton, capturing 6 Chinese sailors in American employ. Commander John Kelly took the USS Plymouth to Shanghai and sent Marines in to retake the Compton. Marine Lieutenant Robert Guest seized the ship, put a pistol to the captain's head, and threatened, I fucking quote, at the first shot fired, I would blow his brains out.
Damn. He's not messing around. I mean, It would be a mind-blowing thing.
Boo. Lieutenant Guest, being the most marine a marine could possibly be.
So he's huffing glue and drinking crayons.
Yes. Muscles are required, intelligence not essential.
My ass rides a naval equipment, sir.
So the Marines took the captured sailors back to the Plymouth without further resistance from the Qing government. As I assume, the captain begged his men to stand down, and some of those men really considered shooting anyway.
Well, he just held a gun at someone's head, so...
Oh, no, I meant the Chinese captain.
Oh.
If they fight, their commander's head gets ventilated by a flintlock pistol.
Well, you know, Hong Christ, well, he's dying for Hong Christ's sake.
Once they were back on board, Commander Kelly ordered the Qing sailors still on board the Compton to honor the USS Plymouth with a 21-gun salute as they sailed away.
Boom, 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 boom.
We have threatened your captain and invaded your port. Now give us a dramatic military send-off.
That's just the American way. We like our fireworks, you know?
Insert We Did It banner here. A few weeks later, the Qing army attacked several British civilians who were too near the fighting when they captured Shanghai's racing track. The international community in Shanghai panicked. So several American government representatives, John Kelly, and all their British counterparts formulated a plan. They sent demands for the Qing army to withdraw from the racetrack by 3 o'clock on April 4th. The Plymouth, two ships from the Royal Navy, 250 English sailors and Marines, and 150 American troops started marching towards the racetrack.
Bum, 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 bum.
They had their civilians in tow, but nobody bothered to check the route. And they ran into a stream that was too deep to cross and found themselves being shot at by a Chinese army with no cover to speak of.
You know, this is what you have scouts for? Like, oh, we're going to walk into a place where we have, like, issues in. We're not going to check it ahead of time.
Yeah, to be clear, you sent demands for an army to withdraw 30 minutes before you demanded they leave. And you're surprised they're still there and mad at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great planning by the Europeans here.
I'm just going to say this. I have lots of friends who are in the military. My uncle is in it as well. He's also Navy. And one thing they always said is, everyone thinks the military is this highly organized, efficient thing. It's not. It's definitely not. No. It is the most convoluted thing that somehow works with, you know, super glue and tape, if that.
Sergeant glue and corporal scotch tape.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this would have been a disaster had the Small Sword Society not seized on the distraction to assault the Qing themselves. And the rebel triad completely routed the Imperial Chinese forces in that portion of Shanghai. Two Brits and two Americans died, 9 were wounded in total, and all of the Europeans fled the city.
I see this as an absolute win. Wait, am I supposed to be rooting for America here? I forget.
I'm not sure you're supposed to.
Okay.
British records officially call this the Battle of the Muddy Flat. Not because it was muddy. In fact, by all accounts, it was a perfectly clear and dry day. One British sailor stepped in a puddle by the side of the creek, and his comrades jokingly called it the Battle of the Muddy Foot. Someone gave it a more dignified name later on.
There goes the British naming conventions. Oh, this is a new castle. What should we call it? How about Newcastle?
Uh-huh. But Newcastle is spelled Newcastria.
Gotta spell it, you know, really weirdly.
Yeah, it is the British way. So all of the American and British officials involved here were commended by their governments for their great diplomatic accomplishments.
Yes, great.
Because the Small Sword Society was an ally of the Taiping Rebellion. But, at French insistence, both English-speaking powers switched sides and started providing arms and money to the Qing so they could retake Shanghai.
Wait, So they're like, let's give money to this rebellious group. And then they're like, oh, the French want us to do this, so I guess we'll have to do that. And now we're going to give money to the government. We were just trying to coup.
This is correct, yeah.
Freaking governments. Who listens to the French anyways? They're not even that strong anymore. This is like where like David's podcast is at now.
Yeah, but they were like, pretty please, they're killing missionaries.
But yeah, they're Catholic or Jesuit, whatever they are.
Yeah, eh. I don't get the sense the Brits and Americans were super committed to one side here.
Whatever makes us money.
At this point, the Taiping had also started to turn a bit and start instituting strict religious law.
Ah, that can't do. What about the white sticky white goo they're going to collect for this war?
And they outlawed. They would soon outlaw opium and other intoxicants, and that was really the final straw here.
Okay. This makes way more sense for me now. I'm like, why are they rebelling against them? Got it. The money.
Yeah. But to sum up the whole battle of the muddy flat, to end quote from Goldbraid in Foreign Relations, all in all, the U.S. Navy at Shanghai in 1854 did little to promote its country's foreign policy.
Love that.
Yeah, just the very nice academic way of saying, you guys shot a bunch of people and did nothing.
Guess it, jack shit. But we did it in the most American way possible.
Absolutely we did. By putting a gun to a man's head and forcing them to shoot more guns to honor us.
Exactly. 21 gun salute.
Ultimately, the Taiping Rebellion never took Beijing, but stayed more or less successful until 1862. And only really collapsed due to rampant mismanagement and bizarre authoritarian religious policies that included bans on sex and reproduction.
How do you get more members?
That was apocalyptic death cult is how.
Okay. Don't drink the Kool-Aid.
Yeah. In this case, they couldn't drink the Kool-Aid. They had nothing to eat. They were finally defeated, aside from some scattered formerly Taiping bandits, in 1864, with a final death toll of their overall rebellion, not including the independent wars being fought at the same time in China, numbering in the tens of millions.
What the fuck?
China is a very populous country.
I know, but holy fucking shit.
And this was a gargantuan civil war.
Holy fucking shit. 10 million. Holy shit.
Estimates range between like 8 and 20 million.
That's a big range.
Yeah, it's a huge range because it depends on what people are counting.
Holy fucking shit.
Yeah.
10 million. China. 8 to 20 million. What the fuck?
China in the 1850s had a death toll like Europe in the 1910s.
Jesus. No, I'm sorry. I'm saying Hong Christ.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Oh, my Hong. There we go.
Yeah. So that is the extremely abbreviated version. And I bring up the Taiping Rebellion mostly to say that it was going on in the background of the Second Opium War. As in, Beijing was still under siege by religious fanatics when the war broke out. Also, American, British, Russian, and French merchants and mercenaries with varying degrees of official power absolutely provided arms and training to the Taiping rebels.
As you do.
And speaking of providing arms and training, you may be able to get either from the sponsors of this podcast.
Boeing Airlines, or Boeing Airplane Company, whatever. The new whistleblower special, 2 for 1.
Yeah, they just fly a civilian airliner in circles around your house.
Yes.
Eventually something will fall off.
Hey, History of Persia fans, before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
And we are back.
That was a great ad for opium.
This podcast brought to you by Purdue Pharmaceuticals. So we just covered the Taiping Rebellion in a very abbreviated version to tie it into the Second Opium War. The Taiping Rebellion also saw the first genuine American action in China beyond acting as riot cops with the whole Battle of the Muddy Flats thing.
More like, just put a gun on someone's head and just say, give a salute.
Yeah, that also works. That, you know, military combat. So, ironically, despite the whole opium war being set off by disputes over opium in the first place, and the Kahong merchants owing reparations to the British for their lost inventory as part of the treaties that ended the first opium war, the drug itself actually remained illegal in China. Officially, all of these new treaties agreed to hand over Western smugglers to the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
This did not happen.
Of course. Why would we ever do that?
I mean, we're the ones selling it.
Yeah, we're the ones, you know, we're bringing it with full knowledge that we're bringing it in. Your people want it. Let us sell it.
Oh, we are not just bringing it in, Roberto. By 1854... British opium exports in China had surged by 9 times what they were at the start of the first opium war.
So you're telling me the war on drugs isn't working?
Roberto, it's almost 13,000 tons of drugs brought into the country just by the British.
Wait, this is just the fucking Brits?
Every year, just the Brits. 13,000 tons of opium a year.
You think the demand were to go down of 10 million dead?
I would assume the demand went up because of that.
Oh, we're so sad. My husband died. How about some laudanum? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, Russell and Company, our friends from part one, were still the biggest American trade house in China, and they had expanded their operation. Yeah, they had expanded their operation to Shanghai after the American Treaty of Wanxiao was signed. Strictly speaking, Warren Delano Jr. was still with the company.
Goddamn Roosevelts.
But he had moved back to the United States and was more invested in railroad companies and founding universities at this point. But there was another political ancestor running the American Opium Show in Shanghai.
Hmm.
Francis Blackwell Forbes made partner at Russell & Co. and was so deep into the company's Chinese operations, including opium smuggling. He was also a botanist who did some genuinely important work cataloging and studying China's native plant life.
Okay.
But also studying and breeding more effective poppies.
Okay, so like Forbes, like the journal Forbes?
No, I actually wrote a whole paragraph about this because it's confusing.
Okay, looking forward to it.
So the descendants of Clan Forbes of Scotland are messy. Francis here is not from the still Scottish branch of the family that founded the magazine.
Okay.
Nor is he directly related to the General Forbes, whose name is still plastered all over of my hometown in Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh.
This is Francis Forbes of the New York Forbeses, a sub-branch of the greater Boston Forbeses. He is also the great-grandfather of John Forbes Kerry, former senator and secretary of state under Barack Obama.
Wait, John Kerry?
John Kerry is descended from an opium-smuggling merchant in the 19th century.
Gee, thanks, Obama.
You know, I'm not saying that it's his fault, but the opium crisis did get worse during John Kerry's tenure.
John Kerry, continue on traditional family values, bring in opium.
Also, as a fun aside, While I am on the subject of Forbes's Pittsburgh and John Kerry, Kerry's wife is the widow of John Hines, great-grandson of Henry Hines, as in the ketchup brand.
Oh, Pittsburgh all the way.
America's aristocracy is younger than Europe's, but never let anybody deny that it exists or that opium money apparently goes great with condiment money.
I mean, what else are you going to... You know, a bit of opium in your ketchup makes it taste better.
That would explain why Heinz is just objectively better than all other types of ketchup.
Wait, there's other kinds?
Yeah, right? That is a genuinely impressive level of brand supremacy.
I literally, like, I know, like, the... Oh, here's a great value, but everyone's like, yeah, I'm getting Heinz. Plus, I live in Pennsylvania. I live in Western Pennsylvania. All I'm getting is Pittsburgh Altoona shit.
Yeah, no, if you live in Western Pennsylvania, I'm not sure it's legal to buy anything else.
Nope.
You gotta, they sell it, but it's a trap.
It's like, once you buy it, you're arrested immediately.
Well, speaking of things that should get people arrested immediately, and of Francis Forbes, he moved to China full-time in 1857, which was a weird time for an American to move in, to say the least.
What is he doing there, teaching English or something?
Oh, no, he's selling opium, okay. Sort of. You know, teaching, opium, same difference.
I actually knew a teacher who was also a drug dealer in China.
Well, there you have it. A tale as old as time.
Exactly. You get deported.
That is not surprising.
Yeah, he did not show up the next day for work. I'm like, where'd he go? And my boss is like, oh, he just got deported last night. I'm like, cool.
That makes sense. Okay. Mm-hmm. Please don't hurt me.
Yep.
So despite the unequal treaty system following the First Opium War, the Qing Dynasty was still at odds with its Western counterparts, especially the British. The British demanded more favors, more unequal trade agreements, and more naval support from the Qing government when fighting pirates. In 1847, the British even sent Marines to land a surprise raid against Chinese imperial forts on the Pearl River and take them by force to destroy the Chinese artillery there to prevent future resistance. This was after the First Opium War was over.
Huh.
Yeah, just a
what is
real dick move, Britain.
I mean, it's the Brits. I always expect them to have a dick move of sorts. At least the British government.
Fair. In the meantime, the British had come up with an additional money-making scheme.
Of course.
They started registering Chinese merchant ships in their own colony at Hong Kong so they could fly the British flag and get the benefits of being a British ship, essentially giving Chinese merchants a taste of the other side of the treaty system and undercutting the Chinese tax revenue.
Oh boy, that's skeezy.
Uh-huh. It's also how all cruise ships operate today.
Wait, cruise ships do this?
Basically, it's super common for cruise ships or international shipping to operate under the flag of some country with little to no taxes.
Oh, yeah. Companies do that, too.
Yeah, all sorts of things.
Yeah, tax evasion, but legal.
That is effectively what they're doing, what the British are doing at an institutional level here.
I mean, they still do it.
Yeah, fair. But one of these ships, the Arrow, was a former pirate ship. It had been confiscated by the Chinese government, sold to a merchant, and then registered in Hong Kong with a Chinese crew and a British captain under the British flag. In early October of 1856, it arrived in Guangzhou with expired registration papers. So Chinese Marines boarded the Arrow, tore down the Union Jack, and accused the crew of piracy while the British captain was away from the ship. The British consulate demanded an apology and immediate release of the crew. The Chinese government refused to release just three of the captives, for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why the Second Opium War is sometimes called the Arrow War.
It doesn't sound as cool.
Because it was started over the Arrow.
See, every time you keep saying the Arrow, I'm thinking of like the CW show, Arrow.
We failed this city.
Exactly. And I'm like, that's all that's going through my mind. So I just see Stephen Amell just like you know, as an American, like
just doing a salmon ladder.
Yeah, he's doing a salmon ladder, and just like, you have failed this. You have failed this country.
It's just, it's built into the mast. I could see it.
I could see it. Yeah.
So tensions immediately flared. Mm-hmm. The Royal Navy mobilized to respond, and the American consulate called in the USS Portsmouth from the East India Squadron to land 83 Marines and sailors as guards outside the consulate and the affiliated trade houses. They arrived just one day ahead of the British ships, which promptly started shelling and destroying China's coastal forts around Guangzhou. 2 days later, on October 25th, they started shelling the city itself. And by the 29th, the British had blown a hole in the city walls and sent Marines in to attack the interior of the city.
As you do, you know. They finally figured out the combination of, hey, we should probably bring in some melee units when we're fighting these wars.
Yeah. You know, it's just that they didn't have embark yet before, and now that they can do an amphibious landing.
Oh, that makes way more sense, yeah.
Yeah, obviously that's how it worked in history.
Yeah.
So as Guangzhou fell, the American consul, James Keenan, ordered another 67 American sailors and Marines from the USS San Jacinto to land and march on the Chinese Viceroy's fortified mansion, where they kicked down the gate and hung an American flag from the mansion's walls.
America, fuck yeah! Spreading some freedom.
Yeah, well, they followed their orders. But in the aftermath of this occupation of the mansion, Commodore James Armstrong reprimanded his troops and Consul Keenan for doing what was tantamount to declaring war without any authorization from the U.S. government.
Well, Washmore.
They were all in Asia with strict orders to remain neutral in any Anglo-Chinese hostilities. The overseas squadrons did have a lot of leeway for attacking pirates or random islanders, but the U.S. had real foreign relations with China. They couldn't just invade the governor's house.
Okay. Obviously, that governor was a pirate, just happened to be on land, so they're just taking the pirates out. Come on.
You know, that could work.
Yeah, exactly. There we go.
It's not what they did, but it could work.
Well, okay, what did they do?
Well, the Chinese commander in Guangzhou, Commander Ye, warned the American administration that things in the city were likely to escalate, and that if they intended to remain neutral, they needed to leave. Sure enough, the Chinese Navy was fighting the British off the coast by the end of that week, just as the Americans ordered an official evacuation. Unfortunately, as the Americans were leaving on November 15th, a Chinese ship, probably in a case of mistaken identity, opened fire on an American commander's rowboat as he traveled between ships.
Well, that's it. Time. We gotta go back. That's a pirate. Gotta kill them all.
Nobody was killed, but this hit Commodore Armstrong right in his patriotism. The Commodore declared that this was an insult to the American flag.
Hell yeah.
So the next morning, the USS San Jacinto, the Portsmouth, and the USS Levant sailed up the Pearl River and launched their own assault independent of the British on the Chinese barrier forts that controlled the mouth of the river. By the numbers, this should have been an easy Chinese victory. A steam frigate and two sailing sloops were assaulting almost 5,000 Chinese soldiers across four fortified positions.
And you're telling me they lost.
The Qing government just didn't have the military capacity to be fighting this war on short notice. They were out of supplies and they were out of ammunition. You can't fight boats with pole arms. So they had to abandon the forts.
Well, this sounds like an Assassin's Creed game now.
As the Chinese were preparing to leave their fortifications, a full 3,000 soldiers diverted from the battle against the British to reinforce their comrades against the Americans, but the American ships just turned a little bit and shelled this entire army to smithereens while the landing party captured two more of the coastal fortifications.
Hot damn! Looking, really looking out for fireworks today.
The Chinese suffered between 250 and 500 dead and lost four forts containing almost 200 artillery pieces. The Americans counted up 10 dead, 22 wounded, and the U.S. San Jacinto hadn't even been hit.
So they had all that artillery, but no ammunition to use it with.
Exactly.
Oh my god. It's horrible. I mean, great for America. Horrible for the Chinese.
Just embarrassing comedy of errors.
I feel like I'm also sending out really mixed signals here.
And you gotta imagine you're like one of 500 dudes watching 3,000 men turn around and run away. And you're like, did we do that? I don't feel like we get credit for that.
Run away! Run away!
So after this battle of the Pearl River forts, the East India Squadron withdrew alongside the rest of the American diplomatic presence in Guangzhou, just as the French arrived in a surprise 19th century alliance with Britain.
Oh. Ho 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 ho! We are here!
The Brits actually asked the Americans and the Russians to intervene as well, but both remained officially neutral. In the American case, the year was 1856, and they specifically cited their growing concerns with Nicaragua.
Oh, for the Russians, it was the rule of Alexander II. And he was he was actually a very peaceful czar, minus the Crimean stuff. But still, took Russia to its zenith and then sold Alaska.
Yeah, it is hilarious that we're in China and the British and the French are like, hey, Russia, come help us.
Mm-hmm. They're like, nah. We're
within years of the Crimean War.
Oh, yeah, that's
or is it going on at this point?
No, I think it's a bit later.
No. Oh, it just ended.
Oh, that...
It literally just ended.
There we go. It just ended. So, yeah, that was not fun for the Russians.
It ended, like, a couple months ago, and they're like, hey, Russia, you want to come be friends?
Yeah. Alex the Liberator is in charge now. Ha-ha. Go, Sasha. Sasha, too.
Yeah, the Tsar Liberator. I'm sure that ends well.
It's a bit of an explosive ending. You never saw it coming.
So, back in China, instead, the American diplomatic, military, and merchant presence fled to Hong Kong and French Indochina for the first few years of the Second Opium War. Mm-hmm. Despite the initial surge into Guangzhou, the British weren't able to keep that momentum going, and the siege of the city stalled when their reinforcements got sidetracked suppressing a rebellion in India. Because... British Empire, baby!
Woo-wee!
That only lasted a year, though, and the Redcoats occupied all of Guangzhou, captured and exiled Commander Ye, and prepared to expand the war effort for 1858. Envoys from the United States and all of the actual major colonial powers involved, Russia, France, and Britain, went to Tientsin to negotiate with the Qing government. The city was only recently retaken from the Taiping rebels and still bore scars from that battle.
Oh, they had to take out all the crosses of Hong?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Like actually, yes.
Oh.
This actually did result in some concessions from the Chinese, particularly offering to open up 11 more ports to Western merchants and allowing the four Western nations involved to establish embassies in Beijing itself, which was an unprecedented level of access for foreigners to have to the court.
Mm-hmm.
It also gave them free access of the Yangtze River and more freedom of movement within China. This was more than they could have realistically hoped to ask China for before the war started. But negotiations were ongoing because now that they were fighting and China was very clearly losing, the British thought they could get more out of this deal.
I mean, why not? They're obviously going to keep losing.
Yeah, they do not have a chance because the British are not going to run out of Indian cannon fodder.
Nope.
But even as the negotiations went on and the Qing government kept offering concessions, the British and French were leading a campaign to attack and occupy towns along the Hai River. One of these cities was Taku, guarded by a series of forts, much like Guangzhou. The forts fell without any fight in May of 1858, allowing the Franco-British squadron to sail further up the river. This was, in fact, a trap. While the British were away, the Xianfeng Emperor appointed General Senge Rinchen to take command of all six forts with 4,000 soldiers. Senge was an interesting dude. He was actually a Mongolian prince, as Mongolia had been conquered by China about 100 years earlier.
How the turntables?
Well, it gets better. Senge was literally a direct male line descendant of Khasar, one of Genghis Khan's brothers.
I mean, oh, not Genghis Khan's, but
yeah, Genghis Khan.
Yeah, but like his brother, not him directly. And that's interesting.
Well, but think about Genghis and think about how nobility works. He was absolutely descended from a female descendant of Genghis Khan.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. So still related to Genghis Khan somehow. Well,
oh yeah, either absolutely way, related in multiple ways.
Yes, okay, got it.
Yeah, Senge had just spent the last 4 years fighting the Taiping Rebellion in northern China, and he was now the imperial commissioner in command of the whole region.
That doesn't sound good.
Yeah, the Chinese reinforcements at the Taku Forts were a complete surprise to the British, the French, and Josiah Tatnall III, the current commodore of the American East India Squadron. Officially, Josiah was still under orders to remain neutral, so he hired a local steamer, a cargo ship called the Toei Wan, and sailed to Taku unofficially so that he personally could join a fleet of 21 British and French ships during the assault on the fort.
Oh my gosh. So he goes AWOL to fight.
I think he takes leave to go participate in a battle.
He's also in charge. Who does he have to ask? The president? Well, he's too far.
Yeah, the consul, I think. Maybe. It's very unclear how the rules are working here.
Oh my gosh. This is crazy.
Not only did he go as a private individual to participate, he volunteered for scouting duty.
What the fuck?
He took his unassuming steamer up to the mouth of the river, where they promptly ran aground and got stuck in the mudflats for several hours.
Why was this not the Battle of the Mudflats?
Because it's the Battle of the Taku Forts instead, because they're more interesting.
Yeah.
The next day, as British and French ships approached the mouth of the river, Senge Rinchen ordered his forts to open fire, and explosions and cannonballs rained in from all sides. The first wave of Western ships were ripped apart and the rest came under a steady barrage as the Chinese Navy engaged. The British commander was wounded and Josiah Tatnall took a rowboat to the British flagship, only for that boat to be sunk, killing one of the American sailors he had brought with him and wounding another. None of them were legally there.
Well, we can't get mad because they left on their own prerogative.
All told, the Western Allies suffered 94 dead, 369 wounded, and lost 6 British gunboats. The Chinese only took 32 casualties in total.
That's a complete difference compared to what you told me with the 10 million fucking dead.
Well, that's for the whole Taiping Rebellion. This is one battle of the Opium War.
Okay, okay.
Josiah Tatnall was officially reprimanded for breaking American neutrality, to which he said, "Blood is thicker than water," because historically that phrase has usually meant that blood shed is more important than natural existing relationships.
Interesting.
Predictably, the British and French did not respond kindly to the Second Battle of the Taku Forts.
Well, they lost 6 gunboats.
Well, they suffered an almost 50% casualty rate. That'll piss some people off. So they returned with over 17,000 troops,
well,
including 1,000 from one of Britain's most elite cavalry units, and 173 ships the next summer, and they sacked Taku before moving inland.
Oh, are we getting to the part where the Brits burned down Beijing?
We are right there.
Hell yeah! I know this bit. I was in the area where they did it.
In retaliation, the Qing captured and detained British military and diplomatic officials and a journalist named Thomas Bowlby for interrogation, which was mostly gruesome torture. Several were executed, as were Chinese indentured servants in British service. Again, more on them later.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans stayed out of this, but I have to describe a little bit of the climactic battle, because at least for the Anglo-French officer class, it had to be surreal once they learned a little bit about Senge Rinchen. A literal descendant of Genghis Khan took command of the best Mongol cavalry on September 18th, 1860.
Oh my god.
At Zhangjiawan, outside of Beijing. And he engaged the Europeans in a massive cavalry battle.
I'm hoping he wins, but I don't think so.
You already know where this ends. He was forced to make a strategic retreat and abandon his artillery, but Senge squared off again at a bridge outside of Beijing.
No, I've had enough Total War to know so that you don't fight Mongols on a bridge.
3 days after the initial confrontation, Senge took the offensive and made a dramatic frontal assault on the French. But it was mostly a glorious, futile performance. They were annihilated in a hail of rifle fire and cannons. Senge himself was captured, and the Europeans marched into Beijing, where the British burned down the Emperor's old summer palace and a lot of the Forbidden City. The Emperor had already fled, leaving his brother to negotiate the surrender.
Wasn't the Empress in charge of time at China at the time? No, forget.
No, not yet.
Okay.
That's the Boxer Rebellion.
Okay, sorry. Just confused.
And here at the end of this war over trade, we will submit this podcast once again to the mercy of brutal capitalism and take an ad break. Hello, everybody. This is Trevor Cully, host of the History of Persia podcast. From about 550 to 330 BC, most of the Middle East was ruled by the Achaemenid Persians. The Achaemenids pioneered the concept of a truly multinational empire, which incorporated people from as far away as India and Greece for over 200 years. The story of Persia discusses the fall of ancient civilizations, the origins of endurance racing, 300 Spartans, the March of the 10,000, and at least one evil priest who replaced and impersonated the king. All before falling with the dramatic close at Alexander the Great's conquests. If that story, and the story of the cultures that surround it, sound interesting to you, check out The History of Persia at historyofpersiapodcast.com, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. We are back. We were discussing the end of the Second Opium War and the British sack of Beijing. This led to a treaty called the Convention of Peking, which was the British transliteration of Beijing at the time. All of the major powers were involved in this, but because of Josiah Tattenhall's breach of neutrality, this stalled negotiations for the American delegates temporarily.
Damn it, Josiah.
I just wanted to fight a battle.
Just the one, and then I ran aground my ship.
Yeah, then I drove into the mud and got stuck. The Convention of Peking had seven main points. One, China signing the Treaty of Tientsin, which granted a whole bunch of additional trade rights to the European and American powers. Two, Tientsin would become a treaty port on the Yellow River to give them an inland place to carry out official business.
Like selling drugs.
Three was ceding the number one district of Kowloon to Britain as part of their Hong Kong colony. Four, freedom of religion had to be established in China, aka the freedom for missionaries to proselytize, which must have felt a little bit weird with Taiping rebels still fighting in the south.
All praise Hong Christ!
It's just the most bizarre thing to have ever happened.
I know.
Five, they had to pay an indemnity to Britain and France, increasing to 8 million taels of silver apiece, which was a unit of weight at the time.
Okay.
Yeah,
how much does a tail weigh?
Let's see. Google break. About 50 grams, or 1 3/4 of an ounce.
Okay.
So, like, not a huge amount, but anything's huge when you count it by 8 million.
That's also very true. The French and the weird metric systems.
Freedom units all the way.
Hell yeah.
Six was legalization of the opium trade, because somebody forgot that part the first time around. Ironically, for that last one, the British Prime Minister, William Gladstone, was morally opposed to the horrific opium addiction his empire had inflicted on China, but not opposed enough to dispute the terms of the treaty.
I mean, I don't like it personally, but we're making money off of it, so...
He was campaigning hard to make it illegal to sell, but he didn't want to fight this and keep the war going.
Makes sense.
The last point in the treaty was something that I have been saving for the end, because it is a bit horrifying and really, really important to American history. Finally, British ships were to be allowed to carry indentured Chinese to the Americas.
Wait a second. Is that where we get all the Chinese rail workers?
That is exactly where we get all of the Chinese rail workers.
Oh my gosh. Now I know why.
The first thing to note is that a ton of sources, both old and recent, refer to these laborers as coolies, spelled in a variety of different ways. I'm only going to say that a few times for context, because it is listed in every major English dictionary as dated, offensive, and disparaging. Put another way, that word is a slur, but a slur with a really weird history that does make blanket labeling it as a bad word more difficult. Mm-hmm. So coolie is a word the British picked up in India, probably from Hindi, where it just means laborer, but possibly from Urdu, where it literally means slave. Either way, it is borrowed into those languages from Tamil, where it means specifically a hired laborer, so not a slave. And in other Dravidian languages, it means wages. So, yeah, weird linguistic history there with a word that went from meaning to pay someone to meaning slave in different contexts. Maybe there is something to that that we should reflect on.
Hmm.
Anyway, in Chinese, the coolie is unrelated linguistically, but ironically also means hard labor. And in the 19th century, the end of the West African slave trade created an opening in European colonies for cheap labor, thus creating a trade in these indentured servants. Chinese and Indian people were pressed into indentured servitude, technically not slavery because it was officially voluntary agreement with an end date, but usually only as voluntary as a completely destitute person with no other options can possibly be, and an end date that could be extended for a variety of reasons by whoever owned the contract.
So basically slavery under a different name.
It was de facto Asian slavery to replace the official African slavery, and as early as 1806, the British imported 200 Chinese indentured workers to Trinidad to work on plantations.
I hate that so much.
Just in case that comparison wasn't crystal fucking clear.
I hate this so much.
To quote one of my favorite podcasters, it gets worse! Particularly in California, but up and down the west coast of the United States, and even some on the east coast, Chinese indentured laborers came in by the literal boatload,
mm-hmm.
Selling indentured contracts or leasing the use of captive labor was so profitable that Chinese criminals, including many of the triads, exported their countrymen to the Americas. In 1859, this caused a diplomatic incident with China, which once again affected Qing attitudes to the Americans in the peace conference at the end of the Second Opium War. The American ship and many others like it set out from Shanghai, where the local triads were running an extremely profitable human trafficking ring, kidnapping people and selling them into indentured service. Ironically, many of the ships coming in from the United Kingdom and the US were also crewed by captive labor in the form of Americans and Englishmen kidnapped and pressed into work aboard criminal ships. Between the two ends of this bizarre kidnapping system, the word Shanghai became a verb meaning to kidnap or coerce.
I knew this one. Oh, they got Shanghai'd.
Yeah, and getting Shanghai'd went both directions.
Yeah, it's like the movie, oh my god, that makes the Shanghai Noon and Shanghai Express movies make way more sense, because they're both about people being kidnapped.
Uh-huh, yep.
Oh my gosh. Owen Wilson, Jackie Chan, what can't you like about it?
Wow. So, efforts were made to curtail this horrible thing, but many of the laws passed were ineffective and unenforceable. Following the Convention of Peking in 1860, the number of Chinese totally not slaves coming into the United States skyrocketed. In 1862, in the middle of the Civil War, Congress passed a law titled An Act to Prohibit the Coolie Trade. But we were preoccupied at the time and the law was pretty toothless.
What were we doing at the time, I wonder?
Yeah, just, you know, shooting Johnny Reb.
Oh, that's fine. It's just pastime.
Nothing of value was lost. The Convention of Peking created a law to preempt this exact scenario. United States merchants couldn't import people from China, but the British could.
Damn Brits.
So they had a thriving business as middleman in a trans-Pacific slave trade. After the American Civil War, renewed westward expansion and projects like the Transcontinental Railroad fueled demand for cheap labor in the West. This was a demand filled by a steady supply of Chinese captives living and working in squalid conditions for little or no money whatsoever.
You know, I knew that they were getting paid next to nothing and were living in like destitute conditions. I did not know it's because they were literally forced, like slaves, essentially.
They were, in many of them were legitimate immigrants, but many, many Chinese immigrants to the United States in the 1860s were effectively enslaved.
Yeah, I didn't know that bit. I was very surprised about that.
Well, a less talked about smaller section of this slave trade, or de facto slave trade, was selling indentured workers to southern plantations, which for some reason had recently lost most of their workforce.
Huh. God damn it. South never changes, does it?
Nope. Uh-huh. Farming doesn't work if you have to pay people to do it. Many of these people were worked to death doing hard labor for the railroads or other construction. Others did dirty, unappealing, or criminal work, ranging from operating opium dens to laundromats. Many, especially women and girls, were forced into sexual slave indentured prostitution.
What's the difference?
There isn't one.
God, I
hate
this.
That's the trick.
No, they're indentured. They can leave whenever they, once their contract's finished. Once their contract's finished.
Yep.
Oh, no, we had to extend it because of these reasons. You extended it 3 times already.
Well, they haven't paid their debt back.
How much?
Never mind that they're not allowed to make money.
Mm-hmm. Does it get worse?
Oh, it's still getting worse. The thing is, because these were technically indentured contracts that couldn't legally extend to children, and theoretically would eventually end, many of these Chinese people or their descendants established themselves independently in their new homes. And the growing Chinese population enticed further immigration from China as people fled the aftermath of the Opium Wars and the Taiping Rebellion. Plus, this was right after the Civil War when the United States had introduced birthright citizenship, so many of them suddenly became American citizens.
Oh, it does get better. And this is where the Pacific Coast gets really good Asian food.
The decades after the U.S. Civil War saw further laws passed to prevent this totally not a slave trade. The Burlingame Treaty of 1868 established post-war relations between China and the United States, recognizing Chinese territorial sovereignty, allowing China to appoint consuls in American ports, just like any Western nation, and established a policy of protecting the rights of immigrants between the two countries. In fact, under the Burlingame Treaty, free Chinese immigration was specifically encouraged to combat the slave trade.
Wait.
It'll get worse.
I was like, it started sounding good, and then you're like, oh, free immigration to combat the slave trade. Like, ah, they're going to pay them next to nothing, aren't they?
The steady flow of Chinese migrants to America since 1848 had created a large Chinese-American population who gained citizenship under the 14th Amendment, and more Chinese immigrants were arriving every day. Can you see where it's going now?
Yep, I saw. Oh.
There were a few problems, namely that Americans were racist as hell.
Were? I mean, I'm from the South. So I just assume...
We're not this racist anymore. I can safely say that the average American in 2024 is not quite as racist as they were in 1865.
Okay. I can agree on that one. I'm just dead into things for being from the South.
Recently liberated Black Americans and their poor white comrades in poverty were pitted against the cheaper Chinese laborers. And as more people moved west in the 1870s, this actually did create a problem where the slave wages paid to Chinese labor made them more economical for American capitalists in the Gilded Age, while also leaving an angry and resentful population of recently freed Black Americans and poor whites, many of them immigrants themselves.
So here's the goddamn capitalists causing class issues because they don't want to pay people a living wage. Rise up, fight against the capitalists.
Yes, exactly. Well, the next thing I have written down is this could have gone one of two ways. The Black and white poor people could have rallied together with their Chinese comrades and overthrown the wealthy overlords. Or the wealthy could sponsor propaganda pitting Asian against the West and straining the United States' already hazardous race relations.
You know what? I guess.
Can you guess which one they did?
The latter, the second one.
It's okay. America's other perennial favorite horrible thing to do came up too. Our fundamentalist Puritan streak that underlies all American culture, that hates vices like opium and prostitution, started gaining power again in the 1870s. And clearly, the opium dens and the prostitutes were corrupting the Americans who kept fucking paying for it.
Wait, so these Puritans didn't have an issue when we were selling the drugs, but now that it's in the U.S., they have an issue with it.
Yes, that is correct. This is all part of the temperance movement.
Temperance movement, stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Separation of church and state in my ass.
Uh-huh. In reality, the percentage of the population engaged in sex work, willingly or not, was pretty consistent across all nationalities. But that didn't stop Ulysses S. Grant from writing this in his 1875 State of the Union address.
Fucking hate Grant.
While this is being done, I invite the attention of Congress to another, though perhaps no less evil, the importation of Chinese women, but few of whom are brought to our shores to pursue honorable and useful occupations.
Freaking hate Grant so much.
There was also another vaguely more legitimate criticism of Chinese women entering the United States. Legitimate, at least in the eyes of the law. Polygamy was relatively common in Qing China, and multiple wives or concubines would sometimes emigrate with their husband. This was problematic on a legal basis because the United States had just passed the Poland Act of 1874, which banned polygamy as part of their ongoing effort to suppress the Mormons in Utah, who, remember, we had just fought a war against in the 1850s.
Wait, what?
Yes.
I remember you mentioned it, but I didn't know we actually fought a war with the Mormons.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Utah Wars were a thing. U.S. Army versus Mormon militia.
Huh. Huh. And it's still around.
Yep.
It's a cult, I tell you.
Uh-huh. They banned polygamy to fight the Mormons.
Yeah. This part I get. I understand this part.
Yeah. Like, that said, the law that came in response to all this controversy was not further regulation of polygamy. It was a crackdown on Chinese immigration.
Okay, never mind.
The Page Act of 1875 barred Chinese women from coming to the United States without an official declaration of purpose in emigration and a personal morality statement.
That's horrible.
Which had to be approved in advance by the American consulate in Hong Kong. Obtaining this approval involved a humiliating and pseudoscientific physical inspection that judged things including prettiness, age, demeanor, and how they walked.
So basically giving all these guys in Hong Kong an excuse to check women out and then be like, yeah, we want them in the U.S. or nah, I should stay here.
Yeah, exactly like
that. Fucking gross. I hate this so much.
They were then required to have their photo taken and send a copy ahead for approval in San Francisco.
I'm just hoping it was a regular photo.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a picture so that they can match paperwork.
Okay.
Ironically, this all sounds draconian at the time, but that last part is basically a modern passport.
Sorry, you did just mention they're basically checking them out for prettiness. I'm just making sure, like, I hope this is a regular picture. So.
Yeah. No, as far as I could tell, that it was just a face.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, basically a passport control. This I get. You just want to know the right person's coming in.
Of course, getting your photo taken in the 1870s was prohibitively expensive in China, so...
Oh, yeah. That's...
That kept the dirty pores out.
Okay.
The Page Act all but barred Chinese women from entering the United States entirely. By 1882, 40,000 Chinese immigrants arrived in California annually, but only 136 of them were women.
Hot damn. That's a small percentage rate.
Yeah. And then they went on to clutch pearls about inbreeding between lesser races.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the only thing to come out of all this in 1882. That was also the year that ethnic tensions boiled over. Despite 45 years of encouraging Chinese migrants and including a clause to facilitate an effective slave trade in the Convention of Peking, anti-Chinese sentiment had turned popular and violent and infiltrated the American labor movement. And all but the most radical labor reformers campaigned on anti-Chinese racism on the basis that Chinese workers undercut American workers' salaries. Not that everyone was being exploited by the same handful of wealthy capitalists, but that it was the fault of the Chinese people for taking lower wages.
That's definitely not the main reason.
Uh-huh.
It's like, oh, you're taking the lower wage. Like, we're getting a job to pay for something. Blame the guy who's paying me this wage, not me.
Yeah. He's even poorer than I am. Get him. Like, what? Just racist shitheads, one and all.
Literally, like, you still see people today that are like, oh, they're stealing our jobs. Like, no, you have... The person in charge is the one offering them a job. Why aren't you mad at them? But no, you can't be mad at the successful man.
So, you know, the propaganda of the time was the Chinese are coming to steal your jobs. It's an invasion. They're vermin. They're not sending their best.
Wait a second. This sounds familiar.
It's almost like we've done this before. Oh, it's like we've done this 1,000 times because it's also what fucking Hitler said.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese immigrants were blamed for an economic recession in 1873. There were fears that the children of Chinese parents voting in large numbers and interacting with Americans would undermine traditional Christian culture and values.
You guys did that yourself, selling opium to a whole fucking country.
You know, it's a totally unique crisis that we haven't been repeating every 15 years since independence.
Traditional family values don't fucking exist.
This all culminated in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which completely banned Chinese emigration to the United States. Rather than calming things, the immediate reaction was a pair of massacres in Wyoming and Oregon, and general violence trying to force Chinese people out of their homes in the year or so immediately after. It would not be repealed for over 60 years, until 1943, when Chinese immigration was allowed once again as an ally in World War II. But it only existed in the first place because of wars we participated in and supported so destabilized China for generations that Chinese captives were used to replace the American slave trade.
So it took us 60 years to allow people from China to come back and emigrate here. What the fuck?
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Roberto, do you have any final thoughts?
I think I've been pretty vocal about my whole thoughts the whole time, but the U.S. fucking sucks! What the fuck? I mean, I knew it did, but like...
Yeah.
Holy shit, that is horrible.
Yeah, this is just a story of the U.S. sucking ass in so many ways.
Yeah, I'm just like, I see why the people hate the U.S. so much right now, because it's like, you did what for how long? And then like, this is why I became radicalized.
Part of why I wanted to do this show was to give some context for the history that other places and people remember that America doesn't like to talk about. And it's shit like this that informs the world's opinion of the U.S. and Britain and our colonial allies. Like, this is history that a lot of the world does remember.
We will sell you drugs, ruin your economy and nation, and probably ruin your government too, and then bring your people over here for super cheap wages, and then once we have too many of them, we'll get rid of you guys, no problem.
All right, Roberto, why don't you tell people where they can find you, follow you, etc.
Find me. I'm most active on Twitter. You can use Czar Power Pod. That's Czar for TSAR. Don't do the CZ crap. That's not real. So Czar Power Pod, or you can do History_Georgia. That one's a bit simpler. I'm on both. I made both podcasts, and then just for my podcast decided, well, I have followers on both now. Can't change it now. You can do that. I run Czar Power, which ranks all the Russian rulers from Rurik to Putin. History of Georgia covers the history of the country of Georgia from prehistory to the modern day. And then most of the co-host Request for Power, where we rank all the European rulers from the fall of Rome all the way to the end of World War I. So, yeah, well, it's fun.
And if you want to hear more from me, I am also the host of History of Persia, telling the stories of ancient Iranian empires from 700 BC to 700 CE. You can follow me on social media at History of Persia or at History of Persia Podcast, because I didn't want to create extra usernames like that. And if you want to continue to support this show financially or support either show and get access to bonus content, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co. Until next time, everyone, don't do any of that shit.
Yeah, I think I kind of need to do some opium after that.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conqueror's Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.